Your business, your life. Weekdays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on San Diego's ESPN 1700.
This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Coming to the back for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys talk about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the Ray Program. I've been bombarded by emails lately about a couple of things. Both are disturbing. One I know a lot about, and one I almost know nothing about, and I'm always honest with you. What I know, I'll tell you I know. What I don't know, I'll also tell you I know. What I know about is this whole business that the 401k plan is not a scam. There are advertisements all over the place that the 401k is a scam, and you're much better off banking on yourself. And I get the whole pitch, and I know what it's all about. And my problem with it isn't that I have a problem with it, because both vehicles are great places to save for retirement, but they're for different types of individuals in different tax brackets, different stages of the game. For the wealthier individuals, probably both are really good. But to say that one is bad, including don't even invest in a 401k and take advantage of matching contributions, which in many instances give you a 50 or 100% guaranteed return each year on your contribution, makes no sense. So I will try to clear up some of the confusion on whether you should bank on yourself or bank with your 401k plan or do both. I'll get to that momentarily. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about this retirement crisis not really being as much of a retirement crisis, although I could debunk that one in a heartbeat too, but more of a longevity crisis. Well, maybe that's a play on words. It probably is to a certain extent, because people are living longer, and so the retirement crisis gets worse the longer you live. So it's a bit of a play on words. And then the other email I got was on Bitcoins. Viewer asked if I should buy Bitcoin. And I said to myself, you know, I've said this on the air, I'm not buying that stupid currency. What the heck do I know about cryptocurrencies and where they're going to be? But doggone it, if you had bought the stuff a couple of years ago, you'd be in Fat City perhaps today. But tomorrow, who knows? So I'll get a chance to quote from people that know way more than me about a Bitcoin. But I start today going back to the reasons the 401k is not a scam, and neither is bank on yourself. Both are legitimate ways to save for retirement, but they're not for everyone. Sit back, folks. Relax. It's the Ray Program. You know, if I hear this advertisement one more time on the radio, that this plan way outperforms any 401k or IRA, I'm going to pull my hair out. I mean, first of all, the pure logic in that makes zero sense. It outperforms way outperforms any 401k or IRA. I'm sorry, that's just a lie. Because you can't say my little whiz-bang way outperforms anything else on the planet. Did it outperform Bitcoin over the last couple of years? So let's get to the bottom of what the plan is. Everybody knows what a 401k is. You put money in, it can go in pre-tax or it can go in post-tax as a Roth. Many times you get a match. A matching contribution might be something to the effect of you put in a dollar, we'll put in 50 cents, up to a maximum of 3%, 5%, 6%. 6% is pretty common. So if you save 6, We'll give you three. That means you get nine. That's pretty good. That's a 50% return on your money. And this is going to way out. I guarantee you it ain't way outperforming it in the first year. How do I know that? Because what it is not an investment per se. It's a life insurance policy. Now, I'm probably one of the few people on the air nationwide that understands a lot of the intricacies of life insurance. I spent many years in that industry. I ran companies as a senior executive when I was much, much younger. And I've had actuaries that reported to me and all that stuff. So I have a little bit of a background in that particular area. And I think that a life insurance policy as a savings medium can be very, very good. I wrote a book that I've never published on it, but I've written on the subject and talked about it at seminars and so forth many, many, many times, trained people on it. And it is for certain individuals, in particular, those that have already maxed out on their 401k plan, a great way to save. But there's this new mantra, it's not new, it's been around a while now, that why should you put your money in a 401k plan? That's a scam. Why don't you just count on your own self to finance stuff like if you got to buy a car or send your kids to college or whatever? And that sounds attractive. Yeah, I'd rather bank on myself than bank on somebody else. Well, you know what? This is nothing new. Life insurance has been around since the almost beginning of time. And permanent life insurance, and what they typically are pitching here, is a whole life policy, not universal life typically, but it could be, or a variable life policy, but it could be. But by and large, it's the whole life policy. And it's an overfunded, typically, whole life policy, where you put more money in than the life insurance company requires of you, so that you get a little bit bigger bang for your buck. And anybody that has studied how life insurance policies can work as a savings vehicle knows that you put post-tax dollars in. The dollars grow on a tax-deferred basis. If it's a whole life policy with a mutual company, there are dividends paid on that policy. And then you can always borrow your money out tax-free if you need income. The dividends typically go into something called paid-up additions, and so it grows your tax-free death benefit. It grows your tax-deferred cash value. You can pull money out on a tax-free basis. You can pay it back at your leisure, and usually the interest rate that you pay is equal to or less than the crediting rate that the company uses, so there's not a real big net cost, but there still is a cost when it comes to growing a policy loan, and that cost could be in the event you ever surrender or terminate the policy. I'm not sure they tell you that part, because there's a huge tax liability when you overborrow from a life insurance policy, but by and large, I can make a very, very strong argument that with a competitive, low-cost, permanent whole life insurance policy, and I'll throw universal life and variable life into that mix, but I don't think that's the one that Bank on Yourself talks about. I can make a strong argument for a high-tax bracketed individual who has cash flow and job security that's already maxing out on other tax-qualified plans. And this is where I have the problem. Because saying something that's a life insurance policy way outperforms a 401k or IRA plan, that is ludicrous. Especially when you look at what happens in the first couple of years. Anybody that's ever looked at a permanent life insurance policy knows that the costs are typically front-loaded. And so if you surrendered at the end of a year or two, you're not going to get as much money out of it as you would have gotten out of it if you just cashed out of the 401k plan without all those upfront costs. So that's just not right. Now, having the ability to borrow money tax-free out of your own insurance policy to help finance things like kids' education 20 years from now? Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Having the opportunity to take tax-free money out in retirement, like a Roth IRA, makes a lot of sense. Can you overfund these policies and put more money than you can into a Roth IRA? Absolutely. So wealthy people take advantage of these all the time. Corporations take advantage of these for non-qualified deferred comp plans all the time. But it is not better and does not way outperform any 401k or IRA. Your financial advisor needs to know about it and needs to know when it is appropriate for you. We'll be back. Stick around. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
There's so much that we need to share. So send the smile.
Listen to USD Toreros football all season long on the Mighty 1090 Radio Network. USD takes on UC Davis tomorrow night at 6 on ESPN 1700.
I thought I needed to spend a little bit more time on this because it's an area that I just simply do not have expertise in. And as I've said all along, I'll tell you what I do know, and then I'll also tell you if I don't know much about something. I have not done a lot of research and homework on Bitcoin, because until recently, I haven't even considered it as an investment opportunity because there's so many clouds and question marks about it. That may be changing, however, but just to give you some perspective, Sean Williams actually wrote about this. I think Sean's from Motley Fool or somewhere. Let me just read from some of the things he said about this because it's somewhat fascinating. You're not supposed to be able to throw a dart at an investment and make a lifetime's worth of money in a matter of months, but that's exactly what it's been like for investors in digital cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and Ethereum. Ethereum is another one, not nearly as well known, but extremely volatile and could have been very, very profitable for people making the right trades at the right time, which is not my expertise at all. I don't even believe in trying to trade your way around these kind of volatile assets. Anyway, giving you perspective, Bitcoin has rallied from around $225 per Bitcoin in August of 2015 to briefly north of $3,000 per Bitcoin within the past couple of weeks. Burgeoning digital currency, Ethereum, has risen from about $10 earlier this year to nearly $390 less than 2 weeks ago. In terms of percentage gain, Ethereum's performance actually trumps that of Bitcoin. By comparison, it's taken the Standard & Poor's 500 about 43 years to return to the 3,800% that Ethereum did in a matter of 5 months and change. I mean, just absolutely amazing. And they go on to talk about, you know, how the cryptocurrencies work and all that stuff. And you're going to have to do your own homework on that. But let me just talk about where some of the risks are. Here's what they say. Anonymity is its enemy. One of the biggest problems with digital currencies is that they can be used by terrorists and criminals to fund their activities. There simply aren't sufficient safety protocols in place to keep bad apples out of the system, which the governments don't like. And if the governments don't like it, they can just as easily take it away. You know what I'm saying? Next, security is a very big problem. Adding to the previous point, digital currencies have to hope they remain decentralized. Otherwise, they could become easy prey for hackers. This is what scares the bejeebers out of me. I look at what has been happening with the leaks in Washington, the hacking of the Hillary emails, and all of this stuff that's going on. And it's frightening how much data, metadata, that is out there on each and every one of us. I mean, every one of our phone calls? Seriously? Our bank accounts are monitored. Every time we sneeze, it's monitored online. So that's a little bit frightening to me. Investment options are limited. Even if you wanted to invest in a digital currency, your options are almost non-existent. One option is to choose a small exchange that has the potential of being hacked. I'll talk more about the exchanges here in a second. And very few people, including myself, understand cryptocurrencies. But there is some extreme volatility. And I think this is the reason why most of us will not want to jump on that train. According to CNBC, a month or so ago, the price of Ethereum cratered from $319 to 10 cents. It's not a misprint here. $319 to 10 cents. That's pretty amazing. It was a digital flash crash. According to Adam White, the vice president of GDAX, a multi-million dollar market sell order and not illegal activity was to blame for the rapid decline in the price. The order purportedly pushed the price of Ethereum from 319 to as low as 224 before it triggered roughly 800 stop loss orders and margin fund liquidations, squashing the cryptocurrency's value to just 10 cents, although it did rebound pretty quickly to 325. Buy and hold. You don't want to try to trade that kind of a thing. And it goes beyond that because there's so much we don't know about the currency. Now, let me just give you the other side of this, because in the little amount of time I spent researching this, I did find that on November 18th, 2004, that's when the SEC first made its big announcement on the ETF GLD, which has now become, I believe, it's the largest exchange-traded fund, that's the gold ETF, on the planet. So when you can enter an exchange, all of a sudden, things look a little bit better. The end of 2005, it had $4.3 billion in assets. By 2006, $9.3 billion. And would go on to top $75 billion in assets in GLD. What's the point? Well, Bitcoin, the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which regulates futures and options markets, last week granted the first ever exchange license to a Bitcoin options service. So without boring you with any of the details, all you really need to know is that should be pretty bullish for Bitcoin. The company getting the license is the Bitcoin Exchange Ledger X. And you can go online and do your own homework there. But, you know, if you were afraid that trading in Bitcoin was not regulated, now that Ledger X is approved by the CFTC, that hurdle is removed. So while I still will not buy it because I just don't yet understand it well enough to be able to go all in, if you are interested in Bitcoin, I highly suggest you do your own homework and your own research. Don't listen to brokers or anybody else until you've made your laundry list of questions that you need to have answered. And remember, never invest any more money in anything that you are afraid that you might lose. Steve Outdoor joins me on the program. Hey, Steve, you ever bought Bitcoin?
No, haven't. But, you know, hearing the story, I was like, God, that would be really nice if for a short period of time I could be Michael J. Fox, get in that DeLorean, go to the past, see what happens to the Bitcoin, yeah, know exactly when it goes up, and then boom, we could get our own island and retire. But
well, when we come back, we're going to try to finance that island. Fair enough. And you're going to help all of us. Steve Alador, our loan financial planner, joins me on the other side of the break. Make sure you stick around because Steve's always got really, really interesting stuff to talk about. While I continue to research Bitcoin, Steve will be telling you how to, you know, make real money by locking in these super low interest rates, which still are considered very, very low by historical standards. 844-RATIO, if you have a question for Steve, emails at raylucia.com. We shall return right after this. She shows me.
Your business, your life. Weekdays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on San Diego's ESPN 1700.
Hey, welcome back, folks. It is the Ray Lucia program, helping you to make better money moves. You know, last week we were talking about buying a home and locking in these low interest rates. And a lot of people have said, well, yeah, but I'm buying high. Name one person that you know that has lived in their home for more than 10 or 15 years that bought high and locked in a low interest rate for 30 years that's complaining. Name one. Because you can always move out and rent the place out. You got that low interest rate, a low mortgage payment, and rents. How much have rents gone up the last 15 years? Come on, be real here. And that's one of the reasons why Steve Allendorf is joining me on the program, as he does every single week, to help you to make one of the best money moves you can ever make. And that is buying a home for yourself, first-time home buyer, helping your kids or grandkids get a home. Now's probably a really, really good time to do it. You know, Steve, if for some miracle Mr. Trump can get tax policy through, my suspicion is real estate's going to continue to go up because we've got a supply-demand problem here. We've got way more demand than we have supply.
We absolutely do. And if it stays like this or even evens out, I at this point don't see any major crash as far as market value. I mean, you know, maybe we'll see it stabilizing. But yeah, I totally agree that there is way more demand than there is supply.
Now, there's also, from what I understand, some pretty good news for borrowers out there finally.
Yeah. You know, underwriting, of course, has gotten way more stringent over the last 10 years after we've had the real estate crash. And there are some things that are starting to loosen up a little bit. That are going to help people get into homes or help them refinance. Basically, when we're doing a conventional loan, and a conventional loan is going to probably consist of about anywhere from 70 to 80% of all the mortgage loans done in the United States, a conventional loan is done either through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, two specific entities. Both of them have underwriting engines that when we take a borrower's information, collect everything, put it down on the application, input it in the system, we will run it through the system for it to then give us an approval. And then we have to basically take what that system tells us we need to get as backup info to finally close the loan. So with both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a lot of the underwriting conditions are the same, but there are some variables as to where sometimes we'll go through Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae based on those variables to help a borrower get a loan.
Can you explain what the difference is between Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae?
They're just two different entities that...
Non-governmental.
I think they were not governmental. I think they're being controlled by the government at this particular point.
Because they were taken over a few years back.
Correct. But those are the sources where money is lent for mortgage loans. Now, with income qualifying, last week we talked about acronyms. One of the ones we didn't get to was DTI or debt to income ratio. So in qualifying for a mortgage, that's one of the big factors for both Fannie, Freddie, and any other loan. So what is a debt-to-income ratio? Basically, what we do is we calculate your income. So if you're a W-2 employee, we're able to use your gross income, not your take-home income. If you're collecting Social Security, if you're collecting annuities, rental income, they're all calculated a little bit different, but that then gives us the income that's part of the debt-to-income ratio. The debt portion is going to be your current house payment, new house payment if you're doing a purchase, and that's inclusive of mortgage payment, first or second or equity line, property taxes, insurance, any HOA, and then any credit debt that you have, credit cards, installment loans, solar loans, if you're paying child support, that's a specific debt. What we do is we take that debt, divide it by the gross income, and that gives us our debt-to-income ratio. Now, with Fannie and Freddie, Fannie, for a long period of time, has kind of maxed out their debt-income ratio in most scenarios to 45%. So if we had a client whose debt-to-income ratio was a little bit higher, if they had a strong enough profile, we would go through Freddie Mac because there was a higher chance that Freddie Mac would give us that approval above the 45%.
Isn't that risky, though, because didn't we run into this problem once before?
Anyway, but it really wasn't the fact that it was the debt-to-income ratio. It was the fact that a lot of people were qualifying stated income, where their stated income was way more than what they were actually
making. So it was
making.
A debt-to-stated income ratio.
Correct, and which was significantly higher than
right.
that 45 or 50%. Well, Fannie Mae has just released where we're going to be able to use them as well as a secondary option to potentially get those borrowers with a decent credit profile approved with a 50% debt-to-income ratio.
So if I make $100,000, what you're saying is I could have recurring debts, including my mortgage payment, property taxes, insurance, and car payments, and all that stuff, of $50,000 and still be able to qualify for a juicy low-interest rate loan?
Potentially. It all depends on the scenario and where you're buying and if it's a primary residence or an investment property.
Okay, so and we're talking about primary residence here, an investment property. Do they still let you go to 50% or not?
With a low loan-to-value,
uh-huh.
strong credit scores, I've seen the 50% with Freddie Mac. So that's a possibility. It's definitely a little bit more difficult to get. And with Fannie Mae, with conforming loans, if we didn't need to bring any cash in over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I really never needed to collect asset documentation because they don't ask for it unless we need that money to close and I got to show the assets. But now it's going to be more important for your lender to get your asset documentation, even if you're doing a cash out refi. I've got a borrower right now where I'm only getting a 45 approval. I can only go Fannie Mae, by the way, on this loan at 45%. But if I can find that they've got $50,000 in assets, once I plug that in, it takes the approval from 45 to 50%.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of nuances within the system right now. And the brighter your mortgage person that you're working with is, the more that we can potentially play with that to help you qualify where you may not qualify with somebody that doesn't understand how to properly put a mortgage loan together.
Now, you brought up alimony. How does that factor into all of this?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. And this is now, at least for Fannie Mae, I'm not sure if it's for Freddie Mac, but in the past, we would have to take alimony and deduct it as a debt in doing their qualifying with their debt-to-income ratio.
That can be pretty substantial.
And it can, and make a big difference. What Fannie Mae is now allowing, as long as I've got the divorce decree, shows where the alimony is going, how much it is, they're now allowing us to deduct it from income. So I did an interesting example. So let's assume that you make $8,000 a month. You're paying $1,000 a month in alimony. And let's say the max qualifying income is 45%. So in the past, let's say that we had to deduct that alimony to find out what your max total house payment could be. $8,000 at 45% tells me that $3,600 is the total debt we can have, new house payment and credit debt. Now, let's say your only debt is that $1,000 in alimony. That then means that the total max house payment that you can qualify for is $2,600. That would figure out to, depending upon what area you're in, property taxes, you know, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000.
Right.
Now, deducting the alimony from the income, $8,000 minus the alimony at $1,000 gives us $7,000.
Right.
At 45%, $3,150 is the total max debt that we can have for both house payment and credit debt. But we don't have credit debt. We've already taken the alimony off
right.
of the income. So you're looking at almost a $500 to $600 buying power increase.
It's another 100 grand.
With them changing this new guideline, which is absolutely phenomenal.
So anyone that's gone through a divorce that's paying alimony, I assume child support's part of that or not?
Well, no. Child support is still going to be deducted as a debt,
okay.
But alimony's taken from income.
They need to contact Steve Alador, our loan financial planner. 888-563-1070. Some really good news out there if you want to buy a home. And I can't emphasize this enough. If you're thinking about buying now, buying a retirement home to move into someday, or helping your kids or grandkids get into something, interest rates, real quick, where are we?
Interest rates are still low fours, high threes. 7 year, it could be in the mid threes. So the rates are still incredible.
He'll do you right. LoanFinancialPlanner.com for Steve Alador, my pal for many, many years. Brings us really the best and mortgage information. 888-563-1070. 888-563-1070. Thank you, Steve.
Always a pleasure.
We shall return with some emails. Don't go away.
Listen anywhere, anytime to San Diego's ESPN 1700. We're streaming live at ESPN1700.com
or download the free ESPN 1700 app from Google Play or iTunes.
Ho, po, po, pitiful me. A blast from the past, Linda Ronstadt. Once upon a time, the girlfriend of the governor here in California. Jerry Moonbeam. Yeah, she had great pipes. That's voice. Sorry, you guys. I think it's time for us to do emails. Hit it, fellas. Actually, I got one in during the show, so I'm going to go to Dan before I post the others up on the screen for our TV viewers. Dan asks, can you explain bank on yourself? Well, I thought I kind of did that. I always thought Whole Life was a ripoff. You know, I hear that a lot, and I hear it from radio personalities or TV personalities or people that are just flat uninformed, because there's a dichotomy that exists out there in who would be an appropriate individual to put money into Whole Life or Universal Life or variable life insurance. But it's not a ripoff if you understand what you're doing and how it could be used in your particular circumstance. Now, let me just say, if you're young and just starting out, no, you should not buy Whole Life insurance. If you're raising a family and you need money, you need all the income that you have, or you might need the cash value from this insurance policy in 3 or 4 or 5 years to, quote, bank on yourself, I think that's a mistake. Where you benefit from a Whole Life policy is long-term. If you funded something and, in fact, overfunded it, put as much as the government allows without the policy becoming what is called a modified endowment contract, where all the tax benefits may be off, you max fund the insurance policy, you do it for like 20 years, and you create a big jumbo cash value. These ads that say you're going to get double-digit returns, that is a lie. You will probably get bond-like returns, 4 to 6%. If you're lucky, you might get 7 or 8%, but over time, figure 4 to 6%, okay? But that's like buying a muni bond or better. If you can get 6% and it compounds and all that stuff on a tax-deferred basis. And what the key is when you get to retirement, you get to withdraw the money tax-free. So now it's better than a municipal bond, and all the loans that you accumulate, for which you don't necessarily have to pay the interest in cash, it can accumulate and make the loan bigger, ends up being paid off by a tax-free death benefit. So it works very, very well as a retirement instrument, similar to that of a Roth IRA. I'm not going to say it's better than a Roth. It's different than a Roth, because you can put $5,000 into a Roth and die and you get $5,000 out tax-free. You can put $5,000 into one of these things, die and get $250,000 out tax-free. So it's different than a Roth. One's not better, one's not worse. And that's the problem that I have with a lot of the advertisements going on. It's like, dump your 401k. 401ks are a scam. Don't do Roth. That is just baloney. It's just baloney. But that does not mean to say that a permanent life insurance policy isn't something that's really, really good for certain people. You need to stay in a high tax bracket. You need to have cash flow. You need to be able to fund it for a good number of time, and you need to leave it the heck alone. If you keep borrowing money out and paying it back and borrowing money out and paying it back, it can work, but most of the time people don't pay it back, and then it ultimately blows up on them. Okay, next, Robin. I was told the rules pertaining to disclaiming an IRA. Can a beneficiary of a 401k disclaim? Can the plan parameters affect this? Well, no. The plan is what the plan is. The true facts are any beneficiary can disclaim. You've got a certain length of time to do so. I don't know if it's 60 or 90 days, I forget. But if I just inherited $500,000 and I'm so flush that I don't need to worry about money, I can say, nope, I don't really want this $500,000. Then it would go to the next in line beneficiary. This is also a good reason to have contingent beneficiaries. The contingent beneficiary could be a named person. It could be a trust, so that the trust could distribute it out. So a disclaimer, and again, for wealthier people, they think about this stuff. For most of us, we don't. But if you are going to inherit, let's say that, you know, a parent dies and you're a neurosurgeon and you've got $10 million in the bank and your sister's a pauper and you're, you know, she's next in line and you inherit, or maybe it's your sister-in-law that's next in line. You can disclaim and say, no, I'm not going to take the $100,000 from mom's life insurance policy. That $100,000 would go to the next in line. So that's how that deal works. Vivian, I have been self-employed and have a 401k. If I start to work for a company with a 401k, how will this affect eligibility and contributions for both? Okay, well, the eligibility will be spelled out in the summary plan description. But here are the rules. You can't put money, at least the maximum contribution, into two different 401k plans. If you max out at $18,000, you can put 9 in one, 9 in the other. You can put 10 in one and 8 in the other, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't put $18,000 into both of them. So what I would do if I were self-employed is I'd dump the 401k, leave that with your company, take advantage of company matching contributions. Then in your own self-employed plan, obviously you're working two jobs. You're working for yourself and you're working for somebody else. For yourself, you could install some kind of a pension plan, a defined benefit plan, a KEO plan, a profit sharing plan, a money purchase plan, something that is an employer contributory plan without deferrals from the employee side. And by doing so, you now can fund two entirely different retirement plans. If you're old enough like me, a defined benefit plan might really do the trick, because you can put a ton of money away in a defined benefit plan. Oh, I could talk all day on that stuff, but unfortunately, I am out of time. But in many cities all around the country, you might get another hour of me. If not, go online. Go to RayLucia.com, and you can watch live. And if you need me, email me. Go to RayLucia.com or just call 844-RAY-SHOW. Now, go out and make it a fabulous day.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of the station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions. Ray is available to take your questions online at raylucia.com.